Welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and Robin Martinez is with me. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Joyce.
Hi.
How's everything?
Thanks. We're doing okay. Next week, I will be in Mexico City for a meeting. You will, too. Meeting
right.
The International Kidney Cancer Coalition in Mexico City, right?
Right.
So, and all three of us are going to be in the same place. Mike is unable to join us this morning, but he is going to Mexico City, so maybe we can take a picture of all three of us that we can use on the website. That'll be really neat. So today we're going to talk about brain disorders, and our guest hasn't arrived yet, but hopefully she'll be here in a few minutes. But meanwhile, I thought that you and I could start the conversation because we've both done a lot of patient support with people with various kinds of brain tumors or brain disorders. You want to kick it off? What is it that you would say, would like to talk with people about?
The one of the big things that happens with brain disorders is that people start having symptoms and they go to a neurologist and they get diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And then they may get treated for Parkinson's disease and the treatment doesn't help them. So the neurologist thinks there's something else going on here, and they start looking further and they find out it's not Parkinson's disease, it's what's called a Parkinsonism. And these are diseases that look like Parkinson's disease, which I think probably everybody's familiar with. Probably everybody knows somebody who's had Parkinson's disease. But a Parkinsonism is different in that it doesn't respond to the same treatments, and it just continues to get worse and worse. And these include diseases like progressive supranuclear palsy, corticobasal degeneration, multiple system atrophy, and Lewy body dementia, which is a particular type of dementia caused by a buildup of a different substance in the brain other than the ones that we're familiar with for multiple sclerosis or for Parkinson's disease.
That's a great introduction, and we've been joined by our guest, Robin Riddle. So, hi, this is Robin Riddle, CEO of the Brain Support Network. Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you guys this morning?
Great, and we have Robin and Robin on the line, so yeah, we can hear you fine. And we're live on the air. And Robin Martinez just gave us a little introduction to how people are often misdiagnosed, and I know that's one of the things you called out on your website. So you want to talk to us a little bit about that? If someone has been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease and the medications aren't helping, what happens next?
Yes, I thought Robin's introduction was very good. So what happens about 70% of the time is that people with Parkinson's disease are actually diagnosed incorrectly. And we know this through brain donation studies where people with Parkinson's are diagnosed and they've died, donated their brains for autopsy. And we know about 70% of them are diagnosed correctly. So about 30%, 25 to 30% are diagnosed incorrectly. And as Robin mentioned, they generally have one of four disorders that are called atypical Parkinsonism. And as she said, a person might go to see a physician with a Parkinson's disease diagnosis. We always think it to go see an expert physician, and we would consider an expert physician to be a movement disorder specialist. This is a neurologist with additional training in movement disorders. And the movement disorder specialist generally tries to determine if someone has Parkinson's typical Parkinson's disease by giving a medication along the lines of Sinemet, which is carbidopa, levodopa. Sinemet is a brand name. And there are other medications that act similarly to Sinemet in the body. And so these medications could also be tried. But the gold standard for a movement disorder specialist is Sinemet. And if a patient has no response to Sinemet, that often indicates that, oops, this might not be typical Parkinson's disease, but might in fact be one of the atypical Parkinsonism conditions. There are several other clues besides the medication. One clue, for example, is in a disorder called multiple system atrophy. The patient often has very early autonomic dysfunction, including orthostatic hypotension. And
so,
what we mean by early
Robin, excuse me, would you sort of translate that into a more common English for a second for us?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So orthostatic hypotension means, generally speaking, when you are lying down and you sit up, or when you're seated and you stand up. So when the body position is changed, in general, for normal people, our blood pressure very quickly re-regulates, and the vessels in our blood vessels in our legs start constricting, and it forces blood up to the head, up to the brain. That's what normally happens. When there's some sort of pathology or dysfunction in the orthostatic system, then that means that the squeezing, the contractures of the blood vessels in the legs doesn't happen. And people feel dizzy, and in fact, they may faint because they don't have enough blood going to the brain. And so we see this blood pressure drop in people with multiple system atrophy. We see this blood pressure drop again from when they change position. So from lying down, a prone position, to seated position, and from a seated position to standing. The blood pressure does not quickly regulate, does not quickly get blood to the brain, and so they may feel dizzy and faint, and or in fact fall. And this symptom is also common in Parkinson's disease, and it's also common in a disorder called Lewy body dementia. But the difference with multiple system atrophy is that the blood pressure drop is even more severe than we see in Parkinson's disease, and it happens early on in the disease course. And what we mean by early on is usually within the first year of symptoms. So this is a clue, this orthostatic hypotension or this blood pressure dysregulation is a clue for physicians that, oh, somebody may not in fact have typical Parkinson's disease, but they may have this other condition.
Now, orthostatic
Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Orthostatic hypotension isn't just solely a signal of these extreme neurodegenerative disorders, however.
Very true. And in fact, many of us, as we get older, start to experience this symptom. And so it's very difficult, I think, for the neurologist or movement disorder specialist or any type of physician to parse out exactly what's going on. But if you see orthostatic hypotension outside of the context of Parkinsonism, then it's a clue that, Parkinson's disease or Parkinsonism may not be involved. So a physician has to look at all the symptoms and in context. You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, we work with a lot of autoimmune disorders, and many of those people have orthostatic hypotension. And I wouldn't want them all to be terrified that, oh my golly, I'm developing a Parkinsonism.
That's very true. And I think this is a common problem with a lot of symptoms out there that my father, for example, had one of the atypical Parkinsonism disorders, progressive supranuclear palsy. And every time I feel like I'm going to fall or might trip or something, I'm always thinking, oh, Lordy, I hope I'm not developing PSP like my father. So I think this is a common problem for we human beings to always fear the worst.
Yeah. Now about unexpected falls, that's one of the highlights of progressive supranuclear palsy, isn't it?
That's right. It's one of the diagnostic criteria. That's right. I've always found the word unexpected to be a little funny here. But basically what it means is that somebody falls and there's kind of no explanation for it. And indeed, early days of my father's experiencing symptoms, he himself came up with an excuse as to why he fell, which was he was unfamiliar with where he was walking, and that's why he fell. Other people have other kind of excuses I've heard people give are that my shoes don't fit well anymore, and that's why I'm falling, or the lighting isn't very good, and that's why I'm falling. But in fact, it's this neurological disorder, this pathology going on in the brain that causes people to fall, and these falls are unexpected. They kind of come out of the blue. An additional related hallmark of PSP, progressive supranuclear palsy, is that the falls are often backwards, which of course are very frightening, and you're far less likely to catch yourself and stop a fall if you're going backwards than if you're going forwards or to the side. One very disabling symptom of PSP are these falls, and especially these backward falls.
It's really difficult with falling, too, because so many people, you say, well, just use a walker. But people who have a neurodegenerative disease sometimes have a walker and simply forget to use it.
Yes, that's a problem. This forgetting of using a walker, we often see in conditions where there is mild dementia or moderate dementia. So oftentimes we've heard stories about people with Alzheimer's disease having a walker and forgetting to use their walker. And the same is true in PSP. And in corticobasal degeneration, I quickly want to point out that not everyone with PSP or CBD experiences dementia, but that is the most common presentation for both diseases, is experiencing dementia. And we think, at least in the case in PSP and CBD, that the frontal lobe is compromised in these two disorders, and the person lacks good judgment to their own safety situation, and the walker is right there in front of them, yet they feel that they don't need it to walk across a room or walk to the bathroom or something. So yes, it is very common, and this is one of the struggles of caregivers and families is, why can't my loved one just remember to use their walker? But that ability to remember and to appreciate their unsafe situation is largely gone from that person now, and so the family has to take special measures to try to help out. And some of those special measures are having a bed alarm or a chair alarm so you know when someone's getting up. A lot of families, like my own, just decide that some number of falls are going to happen, and we didn't want to have someone with my father 24/7 and be at his side the whole time to make sure that he didn't fall. And so we as a family, my father included, chose to not go that route and just accepted that some falls will happen. And, but, you know, of course, that's a very personal decision. Every family has to make their own decision about that.
Right, but you can help make the falls less hazardous by not having, like, end tables all over the place and so on so that people don't hit their head on something as they're going down.
Absolutely, and there are a lot of additional things you can do environmentally, not having throw rugs, adding grab bars in especially dangerous situations like bathrooms. There's a whole host of equipment people can use. Back to the bathroom setting, you can have shower chairs. You can have shower benches, which if you only have a tub, for example, two of the legs, like the left side, two legs will be outside of the tub and the two legs, other legs will be inside of the tub and the person can be seated. There's a lot of other equipment. I'm always surprised that people don't know about gait belts. And the word gait in this case is spelled G-A-I-T. It refers to one's walking stride or walking ability. And gait belts are wonderful tools that family members, caregivers, aides can employ. They go around someone's chest usually, and the person assisting the aide holds on with one hand to the gait belt as a means to give the person with a neurological disorder such as PSP some additional support. And so we use this belt frequently with my father, and when he would start to fall, we would be able to sometimes prevent the falls entirely. We'd be able to straighten him up. Or if he did fall, we would be able to use the gait belt to more easily adjust him down to the ground. And this is a great tool. I wish everybody knew how to use it. And if you purchase a gait belt, they only cost about $10. You can ask a physical therapist to give you training in how to, as a family member, use a gait belt. And it can provide a great deal of assurance in knowing how to prevent falls.
Right, and you can get different kinds of gait belts. Many of them have like 6 or 8 loops or handles around them, so it's really easy to just have a little bit of contact with the person who is at risk of falling and then grab on harder if you need to help steady them or if you need to ease them to the ground.
That's right. Yeah, they're wonderful. Another thing that's, I think, important for every family member to learn is what to do when your family member falls, because at least in PSP and CBD, falls are inevitable. And this is also true to some extent in multiple system atrophy and Lewy body dementia. Falls happen in these diseases. And when your family member falls, at least our approach with my father was we would make him comfortable on the ground. We'd get a pillow, get a blanket, make him as comfortable as possible. I'd often get on the floor with him and lie next to him. And we'd wait until he had some energy to try to get up. And again, you can be taught by a physical therapist appropriate techniques for helping your family member up. And basically the technique is to get on your knees as a the person who's fallen, get on, somehow be There are certain techniques to use to get on your knees. Once you're on your knees, you crawl over to a sturdy table, to a sturdy chair, to a sofa, and use that to help you stand up. Usually when my father fell, he was simply exhausted, and we would often have to wait there on the floor for about a half an hour. And my job really was to comfort him, say it was all okay. Of course, I would have checked him to see if, you know, he had any obvious injuries, but usually he didn't. He just fell down and he didn't hit his head or anything. So it was mostly a matter of comforting him, telling him it was going to be okay, trying to distract him with a story or a joke or something, and then wait till he had energy to try to stand up.
Now, with progressive supranuclear palsy, there's an eye sign that develops, usually often develops later on in the process, that can help with firming up the diagnosis. Would you tell us about that?
Yes, it can happen early on. It can be one of the early symptoms. For most people, it happens later on in the disease course. For a few people, it never comes up at all, which makes their diagnosis especially challenging to make. With PSP, the first word in that term is progressive. That means it gets worse over time. And the S and the P refer to supranuclear palsy. And the palsy is actually an eye palsy. It's not a limb palsy. It's an eye palsy. And palsy means that that there's not a fluid movement, not a flowing to the movement, and that some people actually kind of get stuck. And in the same way as a limb palsy, with an eye palsy, the eyes kind of get stuck. They're sort of staring forward. People often feel that someone with PSP is staring when, in fact, their eyes simply won't move in one direction or the other. Again, this is kind of like the orthostatic hypotension, where as we age, many of us get an eye palsy. Our eyes don't move up or down as smoothly or as broadly as they used to. But in PSP, the eye movement becomes largely fixed in a forward position. And this is often diagnosed by a clinician with something called doll's eyes. So if you remember when we were little kids and played with dolls, we would tilt the head or the body up or down, and the eyes would move up or down. And so, indeed, the neurologist who diagnosed my father, he moved my dad's head up and down, and the eyes would themselves move up and down. But my father could not voluntarily or forcefully change his gaze up and down. So the neurologist asked my father to keep his head looking straight forward, but look at his knees, cast his eyes down to his knees, and my father could not move his eyes to look down at his knees. So this is the kind of classic eye gaze palsy that comes with PSP.
And that explains why the optometrist or ophthalmologist always has people look to the left, look to the right, look up, look down without moving their head.
That's right. Yep.
It's a good diagnostic in general.
We're getting down to the last 5 minutes of the show right now, and I wanted people to be sure to know the kinds of support that you provide for families that are going through these various conditions. So could you tell us a little about your support activities?
Yes, absolutely. So Our organization is called Brain Support Network, and people can find us on the web at brainsupportnetwork.org. And we offer educational information on our website on each of the four atypical Parkinsonism disorders. The three rare ones we've talked about some are PSP, CBD, and MSA, multiple system atrophy. One that's not rare but is not well known is Lewy body dementia. So we offer information on each of those four diseases. And as part of that information, we regularly look at all of the English language publications that have come out on each of these four disorders. And we have on each of these disorders a list of what we believe are the top resources. And again, we've read over all that we know about in English, and these resources, very few of them were written by us. We think, why reinvent the wheel? So there are wonderful resources out there on all of these four diseases. Some of them are video resources. Many of them are print, and they're all available online at no charge. In addition, we also have an email list for each of these four disorders. So when new information from a research perspective comes up, or when lay articles are written about these disorders, we're able to share them with people on our email list. And similarly, we have a Facebook page that's sharing all of these resources as well. Those are the primary things. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area by chance, we also offer a local support group for caregivers of those dealing with these four diseases.
And Robin, you want to give a little plug to what Smart Patients is doing also for these conditions?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Oh, the other Robin. Go ahead.
Robin and Robin work together on Smart Patients, which has communities online for all four of these disorders, and for caregivers, so that everything is in one place, everybody can talk to each other, they can compare notes, they can find out, well, how did you get diagnosed? Or, I'd like to donate my loved one's brain, how do I go about doing that? Brain autopsy after death is really the way to firmly figure out what was going on with your loved one. And many people feel that this is both a gift that they can give and an obligation to society to help society cope better with these diseases by learning more about them. And brain donation is one of the things that Robin's organization, Brain Support Network, does very well.
So, Robin Riddle, could you maybe speak a little bit to brain donation? I know at first blush people go, oh, my God, giving my person's brain sounds pretty awful, gruesome. But it really has advantages both for the family and, as you say, for society. So tell us how this came about and why one should consider it.
Yeah, there are two main reasons to donate a family member's brain. One is to obtain a confirmed diagnosis. We have helped nearly 500 families donate a loved one's brain, and half the people receive a confirmed diagnosis different from the one that their family member was given while alive. So it is the only way to obtain a confirmed diagnosis, and the clinical diagnosis is wrong half the time. So it really behooves us to, if we want to know for sure what our family member had, to donate a brain. And then the other is that societal benefit. So the brain donation allows for research to take place into the causes, the treatments and the cures of all neurological diseases. And this, once the brain tissue is donated, it's saved in perpetuity, so research can go forward. In the My father's brain was the first brain I ever made arrangements to have donated. And in his case, his brain was used about a year after he passed away in a major landmark study of genetics and progressive supranuclear palsy. And in this worldwide study, 1,000 brains of people were examined with PSP. And only through that study did we learn about 5 new genetic mutations that are associated with PSP. They don't cause it, but they're associated with it. So this is one example of so many that where the brain tissue is used for future research. And just because your family member, for example, has a clinical diagnosis of Lewy body dementia, oftentimes when the family member has died, we see that they don't have Lewy body dementia, they have Alzheimer's. Their brain is still utilized for Lewy body dementia research as well as Alzheimer's research, because it is true that clinically they were diagnosed with Lewy body dementia while alive, and that fact is still very important to researchers. And so we're able to determine through brain autopsy studies how clinicians can do a better job at diagnosing, because they, as I said, get it wrong about half the time.
Right, and we know the symptoms while the person was alive. We know the best guess that the doctor made. As you say, it's wrong half the time. But then getting the confirmation after the person died, we can write all that down and hopefully coach the doctors in better methods of diagnosing the people in the first place, right?
That's right. And we encourage individual family members, once they get the neuropathology report from the brain bank, to share that report with all of the family's diagnosing physicians, and as a way to instruct them. And brain banks have become better and better since time and since we've had more tissue donated. For example, on MSA, there was a major study published last year. About a third of the brains in that study had been donated as a result of Brain Support Network's efforts. And from this study, I think it was about 80 people diagnosed during life with multiple system atrophy. Upon death, only about half had multiple system atrophy. And the researchers were able to say, these are the particular symptoms that led neurologists astray. And these are the symptoms that would have led the neurologist to get the diagnosis correct.
Right. Great. Well, thank you so much for all the good work that you're doing. Both Robins are doing wonderful work, and we hope that all families out there who are grappling with these diseases will reach out and take advantage of these great supports, both for people who are living and for people who are going to be diagnosed with these diseases in the future. We hope they'll have an easier path because of the work that's going on today. So any other final comments that either of you would like to make before we wrap this up?
We'd like to encourage everyone to consider brain donation.
And for people to realize, in the absence of a cure, the best that we can do is lean on each other and support each other and help each other through this process of living with a neurodegenerative disorder.
Hear, hear.
Great. Thank you. And thanks to everybody for listening in with us. We hope you'll be with us again next time. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient. Take good care.
hear you, they hunt you. Critics are calling A Quiet Place a terrifying thriller that demands to be seen in a crowded theater. A remarkable achievement. It's the most original and scariest movie in years.
Who are we if we can't protect them?
Emily Blunt, John Krasinski.
Yeah!
A Quiet Place, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. Tomorrow night, in A Quiet Place, if they hear you, they hunt you. Critics are calling A Quiet Place a terrifying thriller that demands to be seen in a crowded theater. A remarkable achievement. It's the most original and scariest movie in years.
Who are we if we can't protect them?
Emily Blunt, John Krasinski.
Yeah!
A Quiet Place, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. Tomorrow night.